And scientists, members of the audience, artists gathering in the Black Hole Bistro, post-concert, come and have a drink, come and have something to eat. It's a wonderful way to end your evening. Thank you very much for joining us, and it's my great pleasure to welcome Edward Bertinsky.
Thank you, Michael. So before I start, I'd like to run a little piece that I prepared. I was at the TED conference, and I won a prize for it, came with three wishes, and that was kind of wild. What I did is I prepared this little piece. One of my wishes was to help this startup blog that has a conversation going about sustainability to get going. They've already been at it for about a year and a half, and they just had great momentum. I love their attitude and positions that they were taking. So I put this piece together to help them promote and also use my work in that aspect. Let me just dim the lights a bit. That's a little piece I did. Now, my career started about a long time ago when I was about 11, and I fell in love with photography. And it really didn't get traction until I went to Ryerson, and I had been told that I had an eye, and I always had a camera with me, and I always used it to explore the world. But when I got there, I was able to get some fantastic teachers, and one teacher in particular, Rob Gublar, took me under his wing and really cultivated a real excitement and enthusiasm. And then he became my teacher and mentor, and it was really life transforming for me to have somebody who could really take some of the ideas that I had and mold them and get me to look at the world in different ways. So there's really about three things that happened to form what I would say is the trunk of my work.
One is the fact that I think part of my Canadian experience is there. My father was an avid lover of going out into the countryside, going up to the Canadian North, fishing, and I had a sense of that landscape. And to me, that was really important. And I think when I've traveled now, and I think of somebody being raised, for instance, in Holland, every chunk of that landscape has been kind of determined by humans. So there isn't anything natural. There isn't this reference point to the notion of geological time, that this is something that's been going on without human intervention and will continue to go on. And I think that having that wilderness experience gave me that, again, understanding of this notion of geological time. The other thing was my teacher gave me this assignment called Evidence of Man. And to me, it was like a tailor-made for me because as a photographer, you're already kind of disassociating yourself from the world at some level. You become the observer. And with an assignment like that, it almost gave me the license to almost become the alien, looking at our species from a kind of an objective eye or outside of the culture itself. So it gave me that ability to detach and just view who are these people that do these things, what activities do they do, and kind of using that as a kind of background for trying to say if I was going to take some images back to the activities of this planet and what they're doing to this planet, what would I bring back? Which I think, again, was part of that process. And the third thing was the fact that I was born in St. Catharines and was raised, my father worked at GM. So to me, being in the face of industrial machinery, I used to go to used to go into open houses into General Motors, used to be McKinnon's and where my father worked, and seeing forge plants, seeing engines being cast, molten metal running down chutes, the whole aluminum suits with building the steering knuckles. I was 7 years old when I first saw that, and I was always kind of impressed with what was going on the other side. It was almost a sense of awe of what was going on the other side of that wall. I heard the forge presses from the day I could actually remember. Every time we went by there, you could hear them pounding away, never having an image of what that was. And then going in there, remembering that and seeing what was going on behind those walls, and then almost always being curious about what happens on the other side. What's going on in those factories and in those places in a way that supply us with all the stuff and all the car that I'm driving, but it comes from that place. So that was very much the three kind of main, I think, forming ideas about what... Let's see. So I did go out for a long time and make. You're going to work on. I did go out for a long time and make just pictures of the straight landscape, and what I call the pristine landscape. And I did that over a period of about 7 years using large format camera, trying to get that camera to resolve information as much as possible to see how far I could push that technology with optics and film. So I was using 4x5 at the time. And this was one of my first landscapes I really liked. And I was trying to find a language within that landscape. And after about 6 or 7 years of doing it, I did other things the whole time. I literally walked away from it because no matter how I tried to frame that landscape, it tended to be kind of drawn back into a kind of a genre of the calendar picture or the postcard or type of picture. And I felt that it lacked the kind of resonance in a contemporary dialogue in art. So then I also was able to get a chance to do a project. And one of the first things that when I went to Toronto, I remember looking at the skyscrapers and walking around Commerce Court, I think I was 18, and looking at the scale of those buildings. And part of what I thought about was there must be somewhere out in nature that has the equivalent kind of size and grandness of a big city, of a city core. And then I went in search of that type of place, the place where I can find that, the reciprocal to this in the landscape. I figured there had to be this negative relief. What I started with was an idea. I got a grant to go across, and I started thinking of the West, and thinking in terms of, again, geological time, and then all of a sudden, the Europeans landed 400 years ago, the rail was put in, the West literally opened up to the Europeans a mere 150 years ago, a blink of time. And it was that rail, that ribbon, that came in to bring really the materials back out and to work their way over to France and Europe and England. And so the rail became to me like a metaphor for this expansion, the Western expansion. And I wanted to find a kind of an eloquent way to begin to describe that metaphor, to talk about. And if I looked at the 19th century attempts or types of photographs done of the rail, and it was always this celebration of the landscape, deep space, river on the side, selling the viewer on the idea of come see the mountains. But what I wanted to do is make a more confrontational approach to this subject. And I looked at it straight on, so and that you think about it, and it's not trying to drive a notion of grandeur and come see this landscape, but it's more of a contemplation of what does this ribbon of steel mean to us? How has it changed our landscape? And it was probably my first real significant series where I started getting recognition as an artist. And then I did there were three parts to the idea, and then I thought, okay, let's go do the mines. We're going there for the resource. This is in Butte, Montana. The whole city of this mine had been abandoned, and it was at one point supplying work for about 6,000 workers in Butte, and then it had shut down when I had gotten there. And it was a large open pit copper mine. Most big mines are copper mines. This mine is one of the largest in the United States and North America. It spans about 3 miles across the top and about a mile deep. It as well is abandoned. I think on the brochure it said if you drive out, it takes 500 miles to drive out the ledges to get to the top. So it's a massive operation. And what I began to think about was kind of the notions of the sublime that in the past, if you look at Turner or if you look at the story of Moby Dick, it's man against nature, nature being the omnipresent force, often man dwarfed against nature and often losing to nature, whether it's in the storm or whether it's by the whale. What I thought now is that, well, now with technology, current technology, we fly over the storms in jets and our ships don't sink very often and our cars are temperature controlled and we're almost isolated against nature all the time. We confront it from our car to the building that we enter, and sometimes, of course, we don't voluntarily go out there and ski and do whatever else. But generally speaking, we've isolated ourselves. But in the isolation, in creating that whole infrastructure to be able to protect ourselves, I felt we released another kind of sublime. To me, it was us dwarfed by our own technology that we've released through the discovery of oil, the internal combustion engine, we've released a phenomenal force upon the world, and it's our human force. So I started thinking about the work that I was doing as defining a contemporary sublime. This is where the homestead, and then I thought, well, who are these people who do it, and trying to define their homestead. So this is a kind of coming together of the rail cuts, of the mining, and the homestead as the three kind of underlying ideas in that thematic work in 1983. I also, in this particular photograph in Montana, again, this whole area was mined, and the mine had moved all the homes. And then once they had gone through and totally disrupted the landscape, people started moving their homes back into this mined landscape without actually re-landscaping it. So this is really the rugged landscape that was left behind by the Anaconda Copper Mine, and then people started to go back to it and to inhabit it. And what was kind of important, what I recognized is the tenacious and the importance of a geographic space for people that what they call home, their town. And they come back to their town, even though it looks nothing like what they left, but they come back to it. And then a boy and his dogs are totally oblivious to the kind of tortured landscape that he's in. I also try to find landscapes. I'm always trying to describe, the photograph has an incredible ability to do what I think motion picture or film and movies and documentaries can't do. A photograph sits there quietly by itself. It demands that the viewer look at it and add something to it themselves. And you break a photograph apart like you would never break a frame apart unless you're going to film studies in a movie. You don't actually sit down and look at one frame. But in this frame, in that kind of analysis, one can start thinking about the horse. And you know, if this was a flashing image going by on a movie screen, you never see it. But you might say that you can start drawing relationships between the car and the horse has gone to pasture. The car is in motion, and that's replaced the horse. The whole type of landscape, how the landscape is rearranged, all the possessions of the owner in that house are here visible and on display. I then decided I did mining, and like any one of these series, I would work on for years, and there might be 30 or 40 images of any given series. But when I decided to do the quarries, it was dimensional stone quarries that I decided to pursue. And the idea behind it was that there had to be these places, I thought, in the landscape that were these residuals of these blocks being removed one at a time. And so I thought that would be a fascinating relief to begin to work with in the landscape. And never having seen these places, my research started to take me to find out where they were. So really, so then I went to try and find what was in my imagination, trying to find something in the real world that was going to be close to what I was thinking about. And I happened to find some very rich subject matter in Vermont at some of the largest granite quarries. And then once I had done the series in Vermont over a period of 2 or 3 years, probably 8 visits, I then went to Carrara, Italy, and did a series in Italy. And that was the first time in 93 where my research started taking me overseas. So I started looking at the globe or the world as my subject matter, not just locating my subjects to a more convenient North American location. So then I started pursuing locations around the world. And these are, again, some of the finest marble that comes from Carrara, Italy. It was quite a fascinating excursion. These quarries were made famous by Michelangelo, who was never happy with the quality of the stone he could get in town. So he started to make a yearly trip to the quarries and hand-pick his blocks. So David and the Pietà and all those are all hand-picked blocks that he would then go and not only find the blocks, but oversee and be with the blocks until they got into the city. So this is a very large, this is very nearby where he used to get his marble from. And the Carrara marble was pursued the world over because of it. It had a translucence that was a full 2 inches. So if you polished the two sides and held it up to a light and ran a pencil behind it, and you could still see shadow. So it had a full 2 inches of translucence in the Carrara marble. So it's very highly calcified and compressed, and therefore very desirable and if you've ever had the pleasure of seeing David or some of those marble sculptures, the light seems to come from within, and that's because it has that ability to transmit light through it. I then went into mines in a more significant way and did mine tailings. So this is uranium tailings that I found around Elliott Lake. So this whole area, when I got there, was already abandoned. Uranium market had fallen through, and there weren't 4 mines closed in one summer in Elliott Lake. This is, you may have seen the actual prints, this is a tailings pond. And every mine that's out there has to have a place to deal with the residual rock, because there's only a small percentage of the actual ore that is the precious metal. The rest of it has to be flown out into these tailings ponds. So, and the orange here is the actual iron that's still left in the water. They're not taking it in Sudbury because it's not worthwhile. They can get iron in much cheaper levels by going to iron ore mines where the grade is about 60%. Here, it's just there's not enough of it to be able to go after it, so they just flow it out. So it isn't as toxic a wasteland as you might imagine. it's pretty inert, but it makes for a great color photograph. Speaking of subjects that make a great photograph, I read, and I get my inspiration from different places. This was a reading that I had done of John McPhee in a book called Irons in the Fire, and he called this essay called Duty of Care. And I read the first paragraph and said, I have to go see this place. And he described this other world made of tires, and there's 40 million tires, and creating a kind of a whole new landscape in this contour. So from his description, I said, this would be a fantastic subject. And when I got there, they were using these tires to actually, they were burning them in a power plant. They were burning them in a very clean way, scrubbing it, and using it to power up 14,000 homes. So there's a continued 24 hours a day, 24/7, of loading this furnace up with these tires. But 3 months after I had photographed it, it was hit by lightning, and it caught fire. So the whole thing spent a year and a half burning, so it doesn't exist anymore. And then I started looking at what I call urban mines, in that I did the primary mines, going into the landscape and showing what that looked like, and I did every type of mine, from silica mines to iron ore mines to copper mines, gold mines. But then I thought, well, there's another kind of mining going on as well, which is I call it urban mining. And it was more to do with the things that come from industry and the things that come from our households that go back into the system. And I kind of saw that type of mining as a more positive human experience, that as long as we don't have to go to the landscape, to that finite source, and if we can somehow design our products in ways to continually loop them around, then our conscience can at least rest a little easier, that we're not depleting everything on the planet and not leaving anything for the next generations to follow. So I kind of saw the whole series on urban mines as a kind of a more optimistic human activity, as opposed to the primary mining, where we're within finite situations and depleting at a high level. So the whole idea of these mines, I went to Bangladesh, and they looked at ships as their iron ore mines. They actually referred to their ships as iron ore mines. And again, the idea coalesced with a story, a radio program on ideas, and they were talking about Exxon Valdez and the accident and the human error involved. And insurance companies wanted to know, or they were trying to figure out what to do, how do you insure against something like that? So they said that problem would have been, you can't stop human error, but what you can do is build ships better. So they said by 2004, all ships should be double hulled, so that if something like this happens, the chances of it puncturing and destroying the landscape are diminished. And so then at the end of the program, they said, and so leading up to 2004 will be a great glut of single hulled oil tankers that are going to have to be decommissioned and deconstructed or broken. And to me, the idea went off, wow, that would be fascinating to see the largest vessels ever built by man in a state of deconstruction. So I went to see where it was happening, and the biggest activity was in India. But I couldn't get into India, so I had to then go to Bangladesh. So I ended up on the beaches of Bangladesh taking these photographs of shipbreaking. And it was a pretty brutal environment. It's almost like stepping back into a Dickinsonian time where there weren't any labor laws, and people were getting hurt, and the conditions were very dirty and very very scary. They pretty much dismantled these by hand. Most of the men are being paid about 10 cents an hour. In this case, there's an interesting anecdote to this one. In this case, I said, well, you have these winches that they fashion out of the parts of a ship. So they're pulling the parts in through these fashioned things from the salvage of the ship. And I said, well, why don't you get a smaller cable, and when you pull a part in, just have the smaller cable tagged behind, and then hook it onto the bigger cable and pull it back through a pulley on the main ship out in the water. And that way you don't have to use 100 men to carry out the cable, which I thought wasn't very efficient. And they said, well, we did it for a while, and I said, didn't it work? And they said, yeah, it worked great. And I said, well, so why did you stop doing it? And they said, well, it's cheaper to do it with 100 men. And I went, let's do the math. I mean, how can it be cheaper? And he said, well, it takes about an hour to take the cable out to the ship with 100 men, and they get paid 10 cents an hour, so it's $10. And we figured it cost us $15 in diesel fuel to run the winch to bring it back. So it's a 50% saving. So it gives you an idea of the economics at work there. Everything works very fast, and I had to react very quickly to this subject. Like I shot that in the morning, and then in the afternoon there was none of it left. They worked very quickly. You can see over, I think over here on the bottom, all this here is all cut up, and it's cut up into sizes that about 50 to 20 men can carry by hand. So they lift it up, and in song they go into step, and then in song they start to move the pieces of metal towards the trucks, and they're trucked away. And most of the metal is being used to create reinforcement bar for their building trade. And again, a very fast moving, and if you look in the picture, if you see the prints, and there is something about seeing live prints, there's a lot more information that's there to be gained versus a screen projection like this. But when you look, you can see the footprints they're always barefoot. So this is literally large metal scrap yards, and everybody's barefoot. It's quite amazing. Just a few more views. Again, it's that has that the power that I loved of us dwarfed against the things that we've built, and the ships were these fantastic backdrops, and I was often using the human scale to set off the dimension of the image itself, so that you can kind of read the image through the human scale. One of the things I had at one point, I think I was doing my projects, and I had what I call my oil epiphany, where I looked around and everything that I was touching and everything I was seeing through my glass and the glass, you know, of my windshield was, you know, it was made through the burning of fossil fuels, the asphalt, the steering wheel and the rubber on it was the seat cover, everything, the dash. I was running on oil and gas, and I realized that all of this is kind of brought to us through this kind of phenomenal gift of oil, of an energy source on a scale that has allowed this last century. If I had to describe our last century, I would call it the century of oil, where we discovered it and were able to really go well outside of our normal envelope of expectation of energy through the kind of use of the millions of years of stored energy, sun's energy in the form of oil. So I wanted to go out and find some landscapes that begin to describe that taking. Because most of my landscape work is to try to begin to define, to go back, and as an artist, to go back to those places and reconnect us up to that kind of disconnect that's occurred in our lives. So we're so caught up in urban life that that we don't think about where this stuff comes from, or for that matter, where it goes. So we, you know, we're busy in our lives. And as an artist and photographer, I thought that to take us back to these unfamiliar places would be a kind of the basis of a life's work. So, you know, at one point, I think 2 years ago, I remember my one of my daughters, I have two girls, pulled out a stuffed animal from her stocking, which comes from Santa, and looks at the label and said, "Look, Santa even shops in China." So I realized that all things come from China, and I thought, how do I begin to describe, again, doing the same kind of impulse, how do we begin to describe what's happening to China? And I was looking at it because, again, through as a question of sustainability as well, that I've been going to the Orient now for 20 years and just watching it rev up. And the whole idea of 2.5 billion people embracing a lifestyle and footprint that we have in the West was something that I thought was a worthwhile thing to begin to put some images around. The first thing I decided to approach was how to describe this Three Gorges Dam, the largest dam by 50% ever attempted on the planet. So here, You see the dam. This is already 15 years in production, and it ends here. So this is the last third in here that is being currently built. I'm actually going there in 3 weeks to photograph this section of it. This is the section here that's been built at this point. The dam is a 1 1/3 mile long. It's 800 meters high, but the water level will get to 780 as its max. And it'll create a reservoir behind here. So the reservoir is in behind here, which is already filled up to 150 meters. It still has 25 more meters to go. And it's been filled for almost 2 years now. And it's creating a reservoir that would go from Toronto, like Lake Ontario, all the way to Quebec City. It's a 650-kilometer long reservoir. The biggest one ever created. 13 large cities were flooded and relocated with anywhere, depending on who you're talking to, from 1.2 to 2 million people were moved in preparation of the reservoir. So the dam itself was actually really a small component of this project, moving that many people and building 13 brand new cities and many, many other villages was really the bigger part of the project of the Three Gorges. So I started to emphasize as well the urban transformation that was happening. This is a shot of the dam looking up. So on this all here is where the turbines are. Actually, GE Canada in Montreal built the turbines, the biggest ones ever done. This dam has the equivalent power output of 18 nuclear power plants. And when it's actually finished, it'll have the power of 24 nuclear power plants. And this is just deals with a very small aspect, a portion of the demand that China now is facing for power. This is in preparation of the pulling down. And they're literally pulling down the cities with sledgehammers, little winches, and torches to cut the rebar. Very primitive, very basic tools, and lots of hand labor. The bricks are highly valued. So this whole foreground here is all metal mullions from door jams, windows. It's all being recycled. So they're literally taking these cities apart by hand and recycling everything that can be recycled. So you can see that. And that was two trips. One was in September. This is 10 weeks later. So within 10 weeks, by hand, they had taken the city apart. And so you kind of get a side-by-side view. So that's pretty much what they were able to do in 10. And I thought when I saw this, I thought, oh, I want to walk around. I was running out of time. I wanted to walk around in there and shoot from windows across and do a whole series in here. And I came back 10 weeks later, that's the fastest I could get back, and found that. I went, whoa. I was a little late on that one. But nonetheless, there were still other things to photograph. I don't give up easily. So again, I was moving up the river and photographing the different aspects of these cities. So you can see here, like what they're doing. All the bricks are being cleaned off, and they're getting what's called 2 mao, which is almost 2 cents a brick. In a day, they could probably clear and get prepare enough for about a $3 to $4 day. So they can do several thousand bricks on a good day. They're all stopping for lunch here. So this is a city literally the size of Fengji. It was one of the oldest cities. It was it started about 3,000 years ago on the Yangtze Basin, and it had about 150,000 people that were living there. Now they are all living in, while they're deconstructing, they're all living in these little plastic tarp homes in there while they're doing it, while they're taking the city apart and recycling it. Gives you an idea of that landscape. The other thing that was being lost as well is a lot of agricultural land, because a lot of the fertile land. And one thing about Chinese agriculture, it was one of the best managed over the centuries through putting organics back in, composting everything. And so the soil was still very rich. So they have lost a lot of agricultural land. And the farmers were the ones that I think suffered the most, because the truth be known, in China, if the soil was good, it would already be farmed. And so what they were getting to replace this good soil was soil that wasn't so good. And again, this is an example of the cities being rebuilt. There was, I think, a lost opportunity, unfortunately, in the rebuilding of the cities, in that they weren't really using the best energy efficient or ecologically friendly types of techniques. It was very quickly and hastily built, and not very well insulated or put together. This is so then I started developing the idea after the Three Gorges Dam. I kept going back to China. I'm going back, I think, fifth time now. And I started to try to draw out what was happening to the Chinese culture. This billboard was something that caught my eye as a really telling billboard about what was happening. And what I found was that all the figures were all dressed in Western clothes. They had bouquets of flowers. It was all adaptations of, you know, the tux, the whole thing was all a Western kind of phenomena of adapting our ways, our traditions. And what was also interesting in the adapted of us is the background that they set. And basically it says, obey birth control law, build science, build our science, civilize an advanced idea of marriage and giving birth. So that's what the translation, direct translation of that is. But what I thought was very telling was the fact that they put an oil refinery in the backdrop as the kind of, you know, aspiration, or the landscape of their desire, and it comes from the embrace of oil. And what's happening in China is there's a massive migration. The government has gone onto a program to try to move people out of the urban environment and to go into out of the rural environment to go into the urban environment. And currently now they call the mobile community of Chinese migrant workers in the vicinity of 100 to 150 million workers that are transient. This is probably the largest in Guangdong province, one of the largest train stations where the workers come from the countryside and come to look for work in the manufacturing sectors. So a lot of these people, it's all their possessions are in the bag, and they're just waiting, and then they go in to try and find work through networking. A lot of the workers, once they come in from the countryside, they're put up by the company. So this is a typical workers' dorm, and you can often tell which ones are domestic. The domestic dorms, which work for the domestic markets, are often unicolored uniforms, whereas the more Western companies allow the workers to wear multicolor uniforms. Like, for instance, here, they're all multicolored. This is a shift change. This is a shoe factory that builds Reebok and Adidas. It's the biggest shoe factory in China. There's 90,000 employees. They're all put up, too. They have men's dorms, women's dorms, and family dorms. I think these are the dorms here, there, and there. I think 50 dorms, and this is just one arm of the company, and then there was another one equally large. So there's 45,000 per, and this is a breaking for dinner. So they're able to feed 6,000 at a time on two floors. They can turn the 6,000 around in about 25 minutes, and then the next bunch comes. Shanghai is undergoing probably the largest urban transformation of any city ever on the planet. This whole area, the whole foreground, will be flattened in the next 3 years, and you'll end up with, again, high-rise cities coming out from behind on that level. So all the old traditional housing of Shanghai, there's going to be just a few small pops left. Everything else has been flattened. But there are changes happening in Shanghai, for instance. These are known as, they call it, it's a Chinese word, deng zihu, or the tax in the ground. And what's happening is that they're not willing to negotiate. They won't settle for what they're offering. So they're holding out. So as soon as somebody settles, the next day they flatten their house. And they're finding these houses that were standing, and these were the people who were still. And what's interesting, what's encouraging here is that normally they just flatten them. But now, they're because of the media, and they're definitely afraid of the backlash from newspaper articles and everything, so they're being far more cautious before they flatten the building. And so this one actually held out for almost a year, which is amazing. So again, looking at this massive transformation of Shanghai, And it's growing at an exponential rate. It's just broken 20 million people and rapidly growing. And they're actually having to, they're having serious problems. And this photograph, in a way, shows, again, the adaptation, the kind of mishmash of architectural styles. So you have everything from, you know, these kind of balustrades and the Palladian window here, and, you know, these kind of big plate glass. And they call these villas. So this is like their townhouses. Everywhere you go, thousands and thousands. There's one development outside of Beijing that I'm going to be looking at. One development has 12,000 villas that are going up at once. So it's just the scale of the urban expansion is really nothing that we've ever seen in North America. It's a five-level highway going through Shanghai. Spiral. The story with this one is apparently a civil engineer was trying to figure out how to move the traffic from across the river in there, and his daughter did this little spiral, and he said, "That's it." So they that's the story that goes with this bridge. This is in Shanghai. This is VW. This is there's 9,000 taxis. This is just the taxis that are going in to Shanghai right now. So this is a shot of the logistics for VW where they're bringing up taxis. Again, where we have a development that might be 40 single-family homes in the suburb, they have 40 high-rises that going up at once. It's absolutely typical. It's not, again, you'll find this type of density and development going up. And it's usually, these would probably end up at about 15 to 20 stories. This gives you an idea and one of the things that I thought I was looking for in this photograph was to find, just again to illustrate the part of my concern and calling it the question of sustainability, is that if you look, every apartment, every window in every room has, they're all air conditioned individually. There's no central air, so there's a very, the technique they're doing to build these massive cities are really anything but what I would call sustainable, because they're very high energy loads in the way they're being put together. And this gives you an idea of Shanghai. It's literally standing from this rooftop and doing a 360. It's a forest of high rises as far as the eye can see. These are coal. China's progress is, and most of their energy, a good percentage of it for home and industry, is coal, and for their electrical power. Unfortunately, their coal is some of the worst in terms of sulfur content on the planet, and they have a lot of it. So the problem right there is that there's a constant of burning of coal. So you always have this haze across all of China. It isn't just located like above any one city. It's right across the whole country. And so coal, this is the largest steel mill, Baosteel, steel outside of Shanghai. It covers 18 square kilometers. And a lot of the steel is brought in, so they don't have very good quality iron ore. Their iron ore mines are at best about 40%. The ones that we have here, for instance, in Labrador, are around 60%. So, and Australia has much better iron ore qualities. So a lot of what they bring in is scrap steel. So the reason scrap steel has risen so high over the last few years is because China is the primary buyer of scrap steel. They also buy electrical engines to get the copper, because it's very high-grade copper. All the windings and all the metals used in electrical engines are very high quality, so they're highly sought after in China. So they do the recycling of these electrical motors from all around Asia, as well as they come up from America and Canada as well. And then e-waste, they do a phenomenal amount of e-waste. 50% of the world's computers end up in towns just north of Hong Kong, just between Shanghai and Hong Kong. There's a whole slew of towns that are involved. And it's very much a cottage industry. So these are all the computer boards are being dismantled by hands, and they're taking all the little gold chips out of the components. Any good metal, copper, all of that is recycled. And there's hundreds of these. This one was interesting. They started doing a few portraits where here's a, she's 95 years old, so she's kind of seen the First World War, the Second World War, and the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, and now this is her front stoop, and now she's seeing her whole town converting to the business of recycling computers. This is Baosteel. This is a new blast furnace that's just going in. This is their sixth one, so this one area has six blasts. This will be their sixth one. This gives you an idea of the scale of it. It's a huge, huge steel plant. And the appetite for steel is unbelievable. This is real time. All day long. And there are, I think that floor is, this is the, kind of give you an idea of the floor. There are about 400 people doing that, and that's just a small tip. Anything I'm doing in manufacturing, I kind of say that I'm looking at the cuticle of the baby toe of the elephant. There's just so much manufacturing going on in there. And what's happening and what's interesting in China is that they're embracing the most advanced, like these are the most advanced textile looms. They're doing synthetic silk here. But you're looking at it, they're not highly paid workers, but if you look at this huge, there's 500 of these looms here, and maybe 15 workers. So they're getting the latest state-of-the-art technology and low-paid labor. And all the assembly work, where there is hand work, they're then bringing people in to do that, and they're not buying into robotics. So they're keeping the robotics out, assembling by hand with low labor, but yet still using all the extrusion machines and all the forming machines and all those. They're not sparing no expense in having the best come in. For instance, Japan was America's biggest trading partner in the United States up until a year and a half ago, where the biggest trading partner with Japan is now China. And it's not buying the cars, and it's not buying electronics. It's buying assembly lines or all this equipment front to back and having it installed. So they're really jumping right into the manufacturing with the latest technology and with a low, massive labor pool. They expect another 400 to 500 million people to migrate in the next 10 years out of the countryside into the urban environments, which is going to be the largest urban migration ever. And the thing about that is the pressure will be there for a long time to keep the wages at a pretty low rate, because if you're not happy, there's a pretty large labor pool behind them that is willing to do the work. And this is the largest shirt factory, Yangor, in China. This is their lunchroom. This is an amazingly big factory. This is the biggest factory I've ever seen. It's a half a kilometer deep, and there's 10,000 people at work here, and they're the largest builders of coffee makers and irons in the world. They make 20 million irons, and I think 2.5 million coffee makers. Even with my assistant's there right now, and he shows them in China, they go, wow. So they're even impressed. You know? This is a computer board, kind of shoring up a road. I thought that was kind of interesting. and they're all stripped. So all the components are stripped and recycled. This is something, I was just at a conference, and there's a gentleman I bumped into, his name is William McDonough. He wrote a book called Cradle to Cradle. And when I'm going through there, I was really, it's pretty discouraging to see the scale and the urban transformation. But William McDonough was asked by Deng Xiaoping's daughter, who is now involved in the urban renewal problems. And so she's heading up, and she invited him to come up with an idea for sustainable cities for China, because to somehow start to grapple with this problem of 400 million people needing a home. So this is, so he's saying, here's the proposed, you know, here's the proposed site for the building, and the previous one, he just said, let's try and keep it like that. Now, originally, this was their plan for that particular site, which is a classic grid, totally disregards the water systems, the rivers, the airflows, and everything. And he said that the city would kind of end up being yet another classic Chinese city that kind of looks like that. He went in there and found all, he wanted to keep all the ecosystems in place, looking for how to mix it with commercial and residential, and how not to lose the agricultural possibilities. He's going to use a lot of solar, and all the factories would pick up solar energy. And so he's basically saying these are all sustainable cities, and this is his template for a new sustainable city, which has full green roofs, but very, very well-established green roofs, and to the point where you can grow orchards on them, and you can have classical Chinese farming on these roofs, and they're all bridged from each rooftop. And then you can see in here, everywhere possible, he's putting in solar collection. All the waste is being taken back and turned into methane. And so he's created a whole template, and they're very interested in trying, because they realize that there's a real issue, and that these cities aren't very sustainable the way they're being built. So I was actually encouraged by that, and they think that they may actually go ahead and build this first city in Lanzhou, this component for 100,000 people in a totally sustainable template. So feels like there is some hope that, you know, they'll start to embrace some of the knowledge of the West to stop, to prevent some of these problems from getting out of control. So that's the visual component of the show, and Robert's going to come up and we're going to have a chat. So that's the visual, and now we're going to have, I think we're going to talk a bit, Robert and I are going to talk a bit through a little question and answer with each other, and then we're going to invite you guys to ask any questions to either one.
We should applaud. I'm Robert Enright. I'm a broadcaster and an editor with Border Crossings magazine, and now a university research professor in art criticism at the University of Guelph. So I live part of my year now in this part of the country, as opposed to Winnipeg, where I live the other part of my year. I'm delighted to be here. I briefly want to thank the two co-sponsors tonight, the Permit Institute and KWAG, for what I think, regardless of my participation, for what I think is a, not only a distinguished series, but a series of art talks that I think are setting a standard, or I hope will set a standard, for what these kinds of partnerships can do. What I know about the Permit Institute already, and certainly what I've seen, it is an extraordinary place. Imagine a place where people come and simply think. I imagine it all the time because I spend a lot of time in artist studios, and that's what they do. They come and they think, and then they make things out of that process of thinking. So it seems to me that the synergy that can come out of the link between the Permit Institute and an art gallery and the artists who are involved, like Ed, promises a remarkable future, although perhaps not one of the scale of what we've just seen. So thank you for inviting me, and I hope this is the first of what will be an ongoing series of conversations about the intersections between technology and art and science and the various ways we live our lives. So where would one begin? But one of the clear things that emerges about your work, and I want to talk about your work as art and not documentation of a changing culture, is the sense of scale. I mean, it isn't just that we see it here on a big screen, it's just that your own work itself and the projects you're attracted to are big projects. Now, where did that compulsion to go after the big thing come from? Was that bred in the bone and bred in your DNA?
I think it's from observation. One of the first things when I decided to do the mining series, I had worked underground as a miner, and I wasn't really inspired there, but at one point, a friend of mine worked about 20 kilometers away at an open pit iron ore mine. So I saw my first open pit iron ore mine when I was 20. And I went, whoa, if you don't see one, you just don't realize how massive they are. And then a couple of years later, I was doing my landscape series, and I made a wrong turn, and I was cutting across Pennsylvania, and I ended up in this coal mining town at Frackville. And I remember I drove, and there was mile after mile of this totally transformed landscape, and I found this high point, and I got up on it, was able to drive there, got up on it, stood and did a 360, and that, if I had a kind of mine epiphany, it was there. It was right. Like, oh my God, this whole landscape has nothing to do with what it was originally. It's been totally transformed by man. But then I realized that in these large, large industrial sites, you begin to be able to almost go into a world that's totally surreal. And so then it brings a kind of another level of reading, because it doesn't feel like the place that we know as Earth. You know, it becomes, but it's totally been transformed by us. So it has that direct relationship to us, but it feels alien. And I thought that was a very powerful and compelling thing to begin to look at. And also, it played extremely well in, again, how do you begin to focus? I mean, the world is replete with subject forming. I mean, there's no shortage of it. So how do you begin to define your research? So I thought, well, it's really easy. Just define it by finding the biggest of everything. So that really gave me a focus then. You know, I was able to then go and say, I'm looking for the big. And once I got, and the other thing that I wasn't smart enough to figure this out, but once I decided to go after that, it occurred to me at one point that this is a great selling point to the CEO who has to let me in. I said, well, I'm sitting in front of you today because you have the biggest whatever in the world. Do you want to be part of this companion I've been working on for 20 years? And they go, yeah. So they let me in. So it really has worked on those kinds of levels, some of them I didn't expect and some of them I expected.
There's a couple of industries I'm going to advise you to stay away from if you're looking for the biggest, if you want to sort of stay away from that. I'll tell you, one of the things that interests me about your work too, though, is that when you were very young, I mean, you photographed the Welland Canal. I mean, I have a sense that you've always, from a very young age, you get your first camera when you're 11, after all, and you went after big projects. Were you conditioned to be a photographer? I mean, at 11 years old, you're developing your own film and loving it, taking 36 pictures of your dog leaping in snow. I mean, this is not a normal 11-year-old practice.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it is here. I don't know what they do here in these countries.
Well, actually, before that happened, my father, I've never gone back to it. My father was, and my mother both were displaced after the Second World War by the Germans. And then they came to Canada, Kapuskasing, and then came to St. Catharines and my dad got a job at GM. And I think that, the fact that I was in this, industrial town and seeing industry all around me, so it was part of, part of my experience. And my father was also very creative. He came, the town he came from for literally centuries or millennia, they were a crafts-oriented town. They made painted tiles for ceramic tiles for stoves, and they did wooden carving, traditional Ukrainian wooden carving. And so he was raised in a creative artisan environment his whole life and his previous, I don't know how many generations. So I think somehow, even though I've never been back, I think I've been kind of, there's a genetic kind of thing that I need to create things, I need to make things. And I started painting when I was about 7, so my father was a painter. He was taking courses in painting and drawing, and he was teaching me along the way. So I painted from when I was 7 with oils until I was 11. And then we got this dark room. He got into photography. We bought a dark room. And once
$25, right? You got 2 cameras. You got film. You got the whole kit and caboodle.
I got everything, and I got the bulk loader. So I had 100-foot rolls of film, and I could blow it up whatever I want. So it was never a restriction. So for me, from the day one, the camera was like I would paint, and so then I would take a camera, and then I'd go into reality and start finding things. So to me, it was totally a transition that wasn't even conscious. It was just that I just rolled into it, and I saw reality as something that is plastic that I just start to mold into the images that I wanted to make, but I was doing it very intuitively. And so the 36 pictures of my dog you know, what I realize is that, you know, even now, it's the same thing. I get my contact back, I look at all the pictures, but there's one or two that really emerge. What is it? What makes that so good?
Now, that eye, I mean, obviously one of the things that also characterizes your work is the acute sort of sense of really focused attention. I mean, even though it's a broad frame and everything's in focus, certain things kind of emerge for you. Did you develop that over the years, or did you have a natural eye for composition? Because your photographs are beautifully composed.
Yeah, it's, trust me, I made a lot of badly composed images.
We haven't seen it.
I don't show those. No, I think that I think it's through working, and I can't, some people ask me about composition, like, you know, how do you do it, or whatever. And it's a kind of, it is a bit of a, what I call a dance with reality in the moment, because photography, one thing that it always does is that you need to interact with the thing. So you have to bear witness, and you have to bear witness in a particular moment in which that subject reveals itself in a way that makes it an interesting photograph. So you can go to a scene, like I'll go to a scene and I'll say, this is a really, let's say, for instance, the Shanghai picture of the forest of the skyscraper.
Yeah.
I went to that same rooftop three times. If it was too sunny, didn't work. If the sky was too blue, it didn't work. If, you know, so it's like they have to have the right amount of haze, the right amount of, so, and trust me, every time I went out to that rooftop, it cost me like $100 because they have to bribe to get up on the roof. So I'm paying $100 just to wait for the moment. But again, you have to, you know, I know that there is that moment where it can't, I know the shot's there, I have to find a condition for it. I have to, and then working on that scale, it isn't like you can light a city. You got to wait for it to occur, and you have to anticipate it. So I think part of that process of seeing what a good picture is, and then being able to kind of patiently wait it out, and or figure it out, and then it really moves away from what I call taking pictures into making pictures.
Yes, that's why Manufacturing Landscapes is the appropriate title then for the show that National Gallery created. You are the maker of the images.
Right. So that double entendre is very conscious that yes, it's a landscape made through the manufacturing process, but it's through the particular eye and the times of day and the kinds of conditions that I chose to photograph that gives it that kind of dimensionality and the kind of surrealness that is a very conscious, and that's where I think the art comes in for me is that as an artist I'm able to kind of anticipate how that thing may appear more interesting under different conditions, like the red. For instance, the tailings with the Red River, there was a Scotch mist. It was raining pretty much, and my assistant was holding an umbrella over my 8x10 camera while I'm shooting that. So, but it was under that condition that the black became this incredible black,
so dense,
and the orange just popped against it. Now, if it was just a dry, regular day without that Scotch mist, the black turns to a powdery, like gray. And you just don't have that dramatic, there's a dramatic contrast. So again, it's like being open to seeing and learning how to see when you see it and to trust your eye, I think it was what I felt as an artist was an interesting thing to develop. And again, trying to find a spot for making the pictures where, because there's a really, like there's, I kind of see two holes that when you work on this level. One is that if it becomes too, I guess, journalistic, it becomes content-driven.
And you don't think of yourself as a documentarian, do you?
No, not in the traditional. I think my work has a documentary value, but I don't work in a traditional way a documentary photographer would work. In other words, I'm trying to find the kind of iconographic representation of something. I'm not trying to go in and, let's say, describe the shoe factory, you know, and make a whole essay on shoe factory. No, I want one picture of a shoe factory that says shoe factory, or I want, you know, an urban. So I'm looking for those kinds of images that sum things up in a very interesting way, and that have that kind of amazing scale that's at work that begins to define the scale that the human species has now engaged in with the planet. So I'm trying to, again, not to You know, not to get into the nitty-gritty that a documentary would, but to sit back and try and look at it in a more of a loose narrative about the human story. So I still think it's about a human story. It's about my story, but trying to connect the things that allow me to lead my life and trying to find those places both at the two ends of the margins of where it comes from in the landscape and where the things that I use up go to in the landscape. So I'm kind of looking at those margins.
When you showed an image, one of the homestead ones, you pull back and your comment while you were doing the talk was, there's the horse. One method of transport from an older generation, obviously a different time, and the car next to it. So you get that relationship. Is it simply because you're far enough back and you're lucky enough that a car is driving through the frame at that time that you get that? Or is that an intentional notion in which you want to, or you find the discovery of comments about transport and where we are in this period of our history as human beings?
Yeah, I think there's a combination of things. Like, I mean, I think there, no matter what, you wait, you anticipate for those salient moments to occur when you're setting up. Now, when you don't just hop out with an 8x10, 4x5 here, and you got
it's not a 35.
It's not a 30. It's not. You don't run out of.
That's right.
It's a very methodic. It's a very kind of determined kind of way of seeing. So you know, I think it's here, I'm going to look at it, I can set up my tripod, no, I don't like it, I'm going to move it over 4 feet, okay, I like it, you know. So it's very, it's incremental as you find the place where you want to take a photograph, and then you kind of hope that some event happens. Like, I could never anticipate that the boy and the dog would happen at that moment, you know, and they'd have this kind of relationship with the other one.
The two dogs.
The other dog's looking on, and the two are having this kind of little intimate moment. You know, it's like, you know, sometimes something looks down and gives you a gift, you know. So some of these things happen, or there's one that I have a train. There's a train with a cargo, and the cargo has a color of the mountain in the back. Well, that one's interesting because I went in '83 and I shot it. At first I saw it and I thought, there was a beautiful moment of light on that central section. Wow, that's amazing. And I set up my camera and waited. 8 hours goes by, you know, and throw every game that you can do off the edge of a cliff, you know, with stones and everything. And finally, it didn't show up. You know, the light never came again. Okay, went back next day, shot it, you know, but it wasn't that light. I could never get that light to happen again. And after about 12 hours, I gave up and walked away. 2 years later, I was back in the same area, set the camera up in the same spot and started to wait. Let's see if it happens.
You're patient, man.
Well, you have it's kind of like fishing, you know. I was working on the idea of the Zen of fishing and photography. You got to have the right gear at the right time, and you know, with the right state of mind, and then it happens. You catch the fish
and a brown trout.
And a brown trout's there, you know. So there was this. So then I was waiting and waiting. The light never happened, but this train started to go by very slowly, with the cargo that was exactly the same color as the mountain. I went, oh, I got to take this picture. It's fantastic. And that became, I think, more exciting than the light. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, because it was that whole notion, what I was trying to talk about was that whole notion of the, you know, that ribbon, you know, taking back the materials to the east, taking it back to, you know, we're the colony that's being plundered, and this is the loot going back, you know. And so, to me, it really talked about and then that because the mountainside is the exact same color as the ore, you know, it's a relationship, even though it isn't the aura, but it's, again, the visual, metaphoric relationship of those two things, and then all of a sudden, it begins to tell the story.
I love the idea, that it's a beautiful phrase you have, where someone leaned down and gave you a gift. I have this notion of you, that you're this crazy human being leaning over for indigenous faces that would terrify most people, scare the hell out of them, leaning into things. I mean, look at the quarry shots in Carrera in Italy, and the granite shot, the quarries you're leaning into. Do you deliberately put yourself in the context in which there's a sense of unease and unbalance in the making of photographs? Because the perspectives are Olympian. You're above it, looking down into it in ways that are improbable at best and terrifying at worst.
Well, I have always said that most of the places I shoot for my mother wouldn't approve of. That particularly like mines and quarries, because it's not just the edges, but they're loose. You know, edges that if you hit the wrong thing, you go sliding down with it all, because they're recently broken up by blasting, and so they're not like, you know, they haven't been like that for a long time. So there's a lot of loose that you stand around. But to me, it's in that there's And I kind of, when I looked at, I mean, I looked at a lot of 19th century photography, so I have been informed by the 19th century photographers, and particularly like a Carlton
Watson.
Yeah. So a lot, I mean, I started looking at, if you look at that work, there's something, and what I call it is when you get a certain distance from a subject matter, the subject matter, you know, like if you stand on the ground and you photograph with a lens, and then the ground pulls off, and it becomes a very familiar view, and the way the midground breaks away, tells a story a certain way. But as soon as you get up, it starts to define the middle ground in a whole way, and so you begin to see the interrelationships of all things when you get into that slightly elevated position, and you can, you know, it's like, you know, Bosch did it too. You know, if you look at the painters, they go slightly at a higher elevation, and then you can start to define and put those relationships together. And in industrial landscapes, they afforded a lot of those kinds of stagings naturally through the fact is that, you know, if you do a quarry is literally a big bowl in the ground. And so, you know, so I would say, okay, the sun's, you're always watching the sun, so say the sun's coming up from my back, so I'm going to be on that side looking across that way. And then in the evening, I'm going to be on that side looking across that way. And each side will offer a certain vantage point. So I'm always scoping, you know, all the possible vantage points and trying to get out to them at the right time of day. So it's always, like the one with the horse and the car, it isn't just, you know, I use topographics, I find roads that are kind of hugging at a certain height. I know which way the sun's going. I know I don't want to be driving along that road going west when the sun's setting, so I will make sure the sun's on my back. I will move across that road at that time, slowly snaking across, looking for potential landscapes. But in a way, like I said, making sure the conditions are in my favor.
But you're legendary for the prodigious amount of research you do. It isn't just knowing where the sun's going to be and whether or not you can find a tertiary road to get there. You do a lot of work ahead of time. Do you always know what you're going to get when you get there, or do you end up sometimes being surprised by what you find once you get to the site?
Well, I'm always open to the surprise, but especially like in working in a place like China, I mean, it's vast. And the subjects are difficult to get into and difficult to get at. So I could spend months and months and months just trying to do that. Having a family back in Toronto, it doesn't work very well. So what I'm doing now is I use a guy that goes out there. He's worked with me, and so he's my remote eyes, and he shoots digital pictures and sends them back.
This is Noah, the guy who speaks Mandarin, so he knows how to get around the country.
He knows how to get around the country, and so I'm using him as an extension of my seeing, and then I'll say, oh, I like that. Okay, go in there and do some more work with that. And get a permission and find a good hotel nearby. So he lays out the whole trip. So then when we have everything laid out, then we start to put the itinerary together, and which we're at this point right now, because I'm going back in 3 weeks, so we're now at the building the itinerary for that. So at this point, like that one factory, the diptych one, the huge one, I knew exactly, you know, before I went there, I knew what the shot was. I needed a lift. I had a pretty good idea what the lighting conditions were. We had permissions. So everything was there. So when I went there, I went right to work to get to make that diptych. So I wasn't, you know, even skipping a beat. I knew what I had to deal with right then and there. And that's kind of one of the ways. And research, like I have a full-time researcher on the ground in China now who's been, Noah, he's been there for almost, with maybe out of the last 3 years, he's not been working for me for about 6 months. The rest of the time he's been full-time research, just sending back images and talking about. So it's very, because China's a very hard thing to work with, and the permission is very, very difficult.
Two other things about your work, you've talked about the light, which is extraordinary very often. Also shows a sense of color. And when I first saw your photographs, and some of the mines with the kind of jade, emerald-colored pools of water, I thought they'd been retouched. I couldn't believe that the intensity and the kind of the solidness of that color was actually there. Now, do you manipulate the images much, or are they actually as you find them?
They are as you find them, because in that type of landscape, like in the one with like the jade color, what's happening there is that, you know, the rains come, so the rain comes down, and you have high levels of copper and iron, but it's mostly the copper for the jade color. So the copper gets picked up in the runoff, goes into the water, and it goes green, you know, from the copper. So it's oxidized copper at a high level in the water that gives you that surreal green color. So it's not like the orange in there is iron. So you're just looking at the minerals in the kind of a condensed way. And sometimes in the quarry work, it's not really what's happening is we get those kind of opaque colors.
Yeah.
Is that if you look, you know, at some of them, you can say, oh, it's clear there. If they're still cutting, what happens is that all the dust is trapped by the water and it goes into the water and it creates a kind of an opaque, and then the algae starts to build because it's picking, the sun's being stopped halfway down, the algae can then thrive in there, so you get these deep green colors and quarries.
Is there a difference between the way you initially see the work, in this is in terms of color, and how it appears? Let me give you two quick examples. One image you showed tonight of, again in China, big panoramic landscape, ruins, kind of wasteland, all kinds of spots of blue in there. And in looking at the image here, what's most characteristic about it is those intense blues somehow are giving a sense of punctuated color to what is essentially a monochromatic landscape. The same thing happens in another one of the Three Gorges photographs, where there's little bands of color where people hung their clothes, and sometimes those little huts they live in are colorful, but basically it's monochromatic with these blazes of color that come out of it. Now, do you see those when you're taking the image?
Absolutely, yeah.
And you want those, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, they really tend to break up what is a very, very monochromatic. Otherwise, you can almost go into black and white film.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I can't go and paint the blue trucks or anything like that. They happen to be there, but the fact that they're, what I would then do is I would sit at that vantage point and really wait till there's an interesting group of trucks,
and it might take 8 hours.
I try to not spend too much time hanging around, but again, trying to look at that, the arrangement of something, and it's taken me a long time to be able to see such vast spaces and keep them kind of organized as images, because I keep pulling back further and further, and still keeping complex space at work, but trying to incorporate even more. So, when I start doing shots of the city of Shanghai, that's a big space, and then trying to kind of it just so when I'm looking at a big city like Shanghai, I'm going, there's a city, there's that building, I can see the opportunity for a photograph. So I'll say, I want to go up on that building, so then it'll take 2 days to get access into that building, and then I say, I don't like it, and then I'll say, okay, let's try another one, So it's this mapping of how do you get the shot that you really want, and it doesn't just happen. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of access and a lot of waiting and a lot of negotiating to get into these kinds of places.
When you see the shapes of color, you want to, as a human being who sees these huge technological developments, you want to read some optimism into them. So I want to see that color as a sense of hope. You told a funny story tonight at dinner about the Johnny Appleseed guy spreading things that you might sort of mention to people in the audience, because it seems to be one of those moments where, in looking at the image, you want to imagine optimism, but in fact it turns out to be something quite different than that.
Yeah. I've been trying. One of the things that that I found kind of a little disheartening that I saw in China, and it also really points right back to that billboard with the refinery in the background and all the Western garb, is that the embrace of I guess so much of a Western mentality that it's hard to find. Where's the Chinese kind of culture?
Mm-hmm.
Where's their dress? Where's their song? Where's their custom? They're of course still Chinese food, but the custom seems to have been severed in many different places. But I was talking with in the Three Gorges. One of the things that was going on once is I saw this man with a beautiful satchel, and he's walking through all this ruined landscape. And he's tossing these bags, and I thought, wow, here's like a ritualistic, like, I don't know, maybe he's Buddhist or something, and it's some offering to the river god before it comes up or something. So we went and we had a video camera, and I was interviewing him, and I said, and I have one of these bags, and I thought, he's going to tell me about some kind of Chinese custom that they do. I said, look at, what are these bags? They were like red seeds, and they're closed up and pinned together. And I'm working through a translator, and then he says, "Oh, that's rat poison." And I went, "Oh my God!" So it was so much for my my hope for a beautiful ritual.
And it's killing all the birds.
And all the birds are dying as a result because they're picking all this seed. And I go, oh God, you know, it is somewhat hopeless. But there was another story that follows that one, which is one where one of the towns in the Three Gorges had to be, most of the towns just went up higher to higher ground. But there was one that they couldn't put up on higher ground because there wasn't enough flat area to build on. So they had to move the town about 40 kilometers. And so they moved the town, and so the town was pretty much flat, and there's a whole community that lives there right until the last brick is cleared off, and then everybody left. So what's left is just this kind of rubble. And within about a day or two after the last of them left, all of a sudden the whole rat population of that town, which was still there, picked up at once and started to move across the countryside. So there were stories of the farmers talking about, you know, these rats just going and eating all the grain and going right through and just literally raising the landscape as they went cross country, and then in one day inhabited the whole new city, like boom. So it was quite a that would have been some great footage.
They'll have to add 11th plague to the old Testament, you know, the plague of rats eating the landscape.
We
have a couple more questions before we open it up to the audience. There's always a question raised about your work. Every critic writing about it talks about this interesting ethical line between you being there as a kind of image taker and maker, and your relationship to it ethically, because what you're in fact documenting, if I could permit you that term, is a process in which there's some gain and there's lots of loss as well. And certainly the Three Gorges Project is going to change fundamentally that country, changes the ecology, changes the temperature, changes the culture that's lost under the water. How do you feel about the kind of the process in which that you're accused sometimes of aestheticizing industrial destruction, and that you're too neutral, that your lens doesn't say enough about what the process is you're going through?
Well, I understand. I do understand the dilemma, and I also, I think it's about that. It seems to be a contradiction that, you know, laying this kind of aesthetic layer over what we see as a kind of a destructive, our own destructive acts on the landscape, but. The question I raise is, like, you know, it really does begin to raise a fundamental question, I think, of how we see ourselves. We see ourselves as part of nature, and that we are entitled, as any other species on this planet, to share in the life-giving kind of processes of any life form. You know, any life form, you know, will, you know, eat and drink water
and consume.
You know, it's part of life. So the fact of the matter is, it's not that we, we're consuming, and I don't have a moral dilemma with the fact that we consume. But the issue is our success is a problem. That there's so many of us, and I think the discovery of oil has really accelerated us and allowed us to function well beyond the envelope of sustainability, while that energy source is there, and. So I see it as a dilemma of our species, and that aesthetic that I put on there is what I feel. I almost equate it with desire, that it draws us to it, and then the actual subject, the content of it, it gives us a bit of a shudder. It's a shock. So it's attraction, repulsion. So we're drawn, and there's a desire. Just as today we are all realizing that a collective impact is having a negative effect, whether you want to call it global warming or compromised water and air, you know, all those things, we're really waking up to the scale of what is occurring, and that this is, and when you start looking at China, it gets even scarier. Mm-hmm. So here we are. So I do kind of somehow see that the work in a way mimics the contradiction and the dilemma that we face today.
Because you want to make really beautiful images. I mean, when you go to Bangladesh, you make sure that you're shooting in the light that gives you that exquisite, exquisite tone, either at daybreak or sunset, obviously. I mean, you want to make the most beautiful images you can to seduce the viewer into that contradiction.
I can't help myself, you know. So it's,
you just don't make ugly photographs.
It's really easy to make an ugly photograph, let me tell you. I can do that all day long. So I don't think there's any skill there. But the thing is to find that kind of moment where it resonates, and I feel that by kind of allowing that kind of veneer, allowing that access point. And I often don't even want to call it beautiful, because I don't know, depending on who you are, whether it's beautiful or not is a very subjective thing. But visually compelling is more like you're drawn to it. You just visually want to get into the picture and understand it more. And I think that that really does offer a kind of a staging for discussion in a much more effective way than a dogmatic, didactic, this is what I think, agree or disagree. And so I do feel that there's a little bit, and it's what I'm finding is that that's what a lot of I see happening, is that there's that different disciplines can access the work and talk about it from either a geological condition or a technological condition or an environmental condition or an aesthetic condition. So you can take the handles into the work and not have to feel that it doesn't relate to that or to that particular discipline or not. It allows for a multiple dialogue on all kinds of levels to begin to try to dissect the meaning. Is there meaning? And so as an artist, I think we're always searching for things that have some meaning, and so for me, these things are meaningful in that these are the activities and the scale of our activities defined by me at this time, and that it allows a kind of, a stepping off point to create a dialogue.
I can think of only one of your photographs in which irony is here. Irony is always the position of someone who's making a judgment about things, and it's probably accidental. It's one of the Bangladesh photographs. It's a big ship, and there's a no smoking sign on one of the boats. Well, that's the least of their problems, I suspect, is the no smoking sign.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's one of those moments, one of the few moments where there's a kind of irony built into the subject matter in your photograph.
Yeah, that one does definitely have it. There was one other one that I thought, I haven't published it yet, but it has it was really nicely defining an ironic moment. But it was I was trying to work on this idea of a green file. Like, these are good things that we do. So I found one of the biggest
a small file.
It's pretty small, but there was one of the biggest photovoltaic farms in California is around where the oil fields are. But what's interesting is they have this huge photovoltaic farm collecting solar energy, and they're using it to drive the jack pumps for the oil. So it's so I thought, hey, there's some irony there, you know.
Wait, lots of photographic commentators, French theorists, and Susan Sontag have said that basically photography is the kind of pursuit of it's the kind of mental mori. It's about death. And it interests me that some of your early work with taxidermy. This is not sort of armchair psychology at all, but you get your first camera because a widow is selling her former husband's camera.
Right.
Your father dies at 46 at a young age because he's working in the various technologies that you're then documenting. You move to places where, in fact, things are being destroyed, and out of that, you're trying to pull some sense of life. I mean, are you aware that you're sitting right on the cusp of this dialogue between life and death constantly in your work?
Absolutely, I think. You know, I think. I mean, the photograph, I do agree with Susan Sontag on that level, that it does represent a kind of a death mask, and that this is its moment of representation in a fairly accurate. I mean, that the death mask, if you look at it, the Egyptians, they tried to really sculpt the pharaoh's face as closely as possible. So this is like an indexical relationship to that human being as much as they can, as close as they can get to it at the time with the tools that they had at the time. So you look, fast forward to, 2,000 years later, we have these tools with optics and the chemical processes to really capture someone's face in a very, very, very close likeness. And then you take it from the face to the landscape. And the landscape does teach us things. I really believe we can learn from the landscape. When I did the bank project, one of the essays talked about when you enter a town, the town, what you see in the town, the tallest building in the town tells you a lot about what the values are. So, in the 18th century it was a church spire, the religion. Later on it was the courthouse, so the politics became important. And now you enter a town and it's the commercial centers, it's the banks, so that they're the tallest. So those are changing values of our societies, and that's the landscape that we create. So when we learn to read that landscape, it tells us about ourselves and what our value systems are. And that those things, a lot of those things I photograph, are there at that moment, and there's a likeness of it at that moment. And then time erases that moment, or like in the tire piles, they caught fire 3 months after I showed it, and that's not to be seen again. Mm-hmm. The quarries I did in Vermont, half of them are now full of water, so now they're just swimming holes, so you'll never see that again. So these things are there, they present themselves at a particular moment in a particular way, just like we look back in our family albums and see ourselves as a six-year-old, and there's, you know, and that's how we actually probably remember our past, more so than almost than the ongoing kind of arc of our lives, that those things puncture those moments and pee us back like a beautiful piece of music or a memory of music that can bring us back to a certain memory. I think images even do it in a more powerful way.
Boy, you'd need a big album to keep turning over. You know, your family album would really be something, wouldn't it?
Yeah, no, I'm kind of like the cobbler and the kids don't have any shoes kind of.
Final thing, you mentioned a lot of artists when you talk about your work, and clearly your success, although you've been photographing for 25 years, it's not as if you're a youngster, but it's been a pretty phenomenal ride in the last few years. Paintings, photographs in major collections, in major museums, MoMA, New York, in Europe, in England as well. Are you surprised by the velocity of what's happened in the last, say, 5 years? That's just the stuff's really taken off, and you're talked about now in the same category as Andreas Gursky and Candida Hoffer and Struth and all the big European and German photographers working in super big attack photography. It's been pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I think as an artist, you can never really predict. When I talk to students, I tell them that there isn't really a formula. The formula is really simple. You begin to have a dialogue within yourself to find out where your intuition goes, where your guts are taking you, what do you like, what do you love to do, and how do you love them, what subjects interest you, genuinely interest you. And those are the richest gifts the artist can have, because once you've got that lift, once you know what it is you want to do, execution is always more rewarding than the process of discovering what it is that you really want to do. So finding what you want to do and having that kind of, when I tell them when you're in school, this is your time to contemplate your neighbor. Go for it. Figure out what you want to do. Think about all the things. Look at work out there. Be influenced by it. That's your time to kind of absorb what's going on out there and to figure out what you want to do and how you want to do it. And then once you kind of lock on, if you're lucky and you lock onto it. And so I locked onto something, over 20 years ago, 25 years ago, that felt right at the time. I wasn't aware of the Beckers, and I wasn't aware of that whole movement. And then in 84, actually, they came to speak at Ryerson, and I said, wow, they're working with minds. And they're the only ones out there at the time that were doing something similar to me. But for a good decade or more, I was doing this work, but there wasn't really any recognition.
And because you were Canadian, of course, you weren't getting into the places where it would be recognized.
Yeah, that's right. And also, I think, there wasn't, big color work, because I was doing big color work. I was doing 30-40s and, in 1985, I was doing big prints. So it isn't, and I was doing big prints not because I was following an art trend. There was no market for big prints. In fact, I remember when I had a show at the Canadian Museum of Contemporary Photography. At that time, it was called the National Film Board, and Martha Langford was the director there. And I had the whole show and they purchased the show, and the whole show was 20-24s. And I said, and this is in 85, and I said, oh, I've got these 30-40s, and I'd love to get these 30-40s. And she looked at it. Well, you're crazy. Those are way too big. We can't ship those and have those go around the country. So I never got them in at the time. So there was a show of I think 38. It was called Breaking Ground. 38 2024s, which I didn't want, where everyone's exactly the same. I wanted to vary it with a whole bunch of 30-40s. But just again, in 85, that was considered a totally foreign concept to have big prints. But I wanted it because the difference with the big print that I was kept talking about and talking to her about it, say, look, when you have a 20-24 and there's a figure in the landscape, the figure is like an eighth of an inch high. When you go 30-40, the figure is a quarter of an inch high.
And
when you go
40, makes sense.
And then all of a sudden, when it's big enough, then you can, and the resolution of the camera is such that you can see the small pieces of the small things, that's when you really get the full force of the image, that it's in the defining of, and in the seeing of the ladder, of the oil drum, of that human kind of scale, and then it allows you to reread the picture, and you get that as a bigger print. So I wasn't going after the big print because it was fashionable. I was going after the big print because of the relation, the visual reading of the picture and how one goes through a picture and begins to break it apart and understand it.
You still love doing photographs?
Yeah, I love it.
Let's get some questions from the audience. Maybe we can turn the lights up out there, and then we won't feel like we're insects and we're about to be turned into a Ed Bertinsky print. I'm more than happy to entertain any questions from the audience. All you need to do is... you want to use that? Boy, it's just like TV. Does anyone have a question? Sir, there's a gentleman here.
At the beginning, you talked about three key factors that were somewhat a part of the genesis of what has given rise to your work. Are there any other artists or photographers that have been an inspiration to you as well?
Well, I think there's quite a range. There's a fair amount, and even like going back quite early, I think Caspar David Friedrich, who did the series of paintings he did with the ships trapped in the ice floes. I remember seeing that for the first time and going, wow, it's that kind of the scale and the man dwarfed against nature was one of the first. And Caspar David Friedrich was one of the first painters to really take a mundane subject like a bush and make it a subject or a tree. So he painted a tree. So he broke away from the grand landscape and went in and started the whole idea of an artwork that can actually revere this nature itself versus man and nature or countryside or a home or a pastoral scene. He was just celebrating a bush. You know, and that was, I think, radical for the time, you know, because that wasn't really something that was really considered subject, that the bush is somebody you walk by. And so the idea that oftentimes a subject can be there in their midst, but we don't recognize it, and therefore we go by it, and that ability to recognize, even early on in Edward Weston, who could, you know, again, take mundane things like a pepper and by his way of seeing, and by making those pictures, he can find the sculptural qualities and the human qualities of body form in those kinds of things. Someone like a Walker Evans, who all of a sudden began to explore the vast kind of American landscape and looking and just plucking those kinds of very salient moments out of that landscape that begin to describe the culture that made that landscape. And that kind of wandering eye that goes, the inquisitive wandering eye that goes and finds things in the world that can kind of resonate and play back aspects of our world.
You're not mentioning Ansel Adams, who would be the person that some people would suggest you're close to in by way of scale and by way
of... Yeah, Ansel Adams did the big, sublime natural landscape and had I been born in that era, I could have easily, gone the way of Watkins or Ansel Adams as well. But in a way that to go up that alley today is to almost, I felt, is to almost to kind of pull back into a sense of nostalgia of going back to a place that somehow a place that we've lost, going back to the garden, the notion of the pristine landscape, and not to say that I have anything wrong to say, but I love it. I actually go out there and experience it. But to me, to photograph it, I don't know how I can photograph it that's going to tell you anything you don't already know about that landscape. But I can show you things about the landscape that I'm showing, that I go out and photograph, that may start to tell you a bit about our landscape that you may not have been thinking about or been aware of. And to me, that ability to be that, as an artist, to be the mediator between that world and our world, and to navigate all the kinds of complexities of a winning trust within the corporate world to let me in, or in the case of China, the Chinese government, to feel comfortable with the kinds of things that I'm saying, so they're not threatened by the work or by the things that I'm presenting with the work. I'm not really sure. I mean, going back to the kind of gaining more traction in my career at this point and getting more of an international reputation, whether that is going to start to impede. It depends. It's a very tricky thing because my subject matter definitely, almost everything you see is a negotiated space with some, you know, a head of a corporation saying yes to that, for me going there. So it's all negotiated space.
Ed is a beautiful phrase. He called the industrial sublime, which is Ansel Adams would be the natural sublime. The scale is there, the intensity is there, the beauty is there, but it shifts into an entirely different frame of reference. It seems to me that's an apt description of what you do. Another question? Gentlemen.
Another Canadian photographer who, although ideologically I think is quite different from the work you do, but whose scale is similar and who also has that sort of view from above, is Jeff Wall. And I'm wondering whether his work was influential in any way.
I didn't. Back when I started this work in 81, 82, 83, I wasn't really familiar with Jeff Wall's work. At that time, I really didn't become familiar with Jeff Wall's work until probably kind of the late 80s. And he comes from a whole different impulse. I mean, I think what, you know, if I kind of understand what he is trying to do, he's challenging a lot of the notions of the document, the documentary photograph, and he's kind of he stages almost everything that he does, and he's doing a lot of art historical referencing, and he's you know, creating these tableaus of you know, highly constructed realities, you know, reflecting on the history of painting and the history of early history of photography, so I think he comes at it from a kind of a very different impulse. And in a way, like Donegan Cummings also challenges our impulse of the document. So it's like a kind of a negotiated space with a model, and so it looks like somebody who lives in an apartment who has nothing in their fridge, and it is somebody who lives in a derelict apartment with nothing in their fridge. But him paying him as a model, and it's all being enacted for the camera, but it's a reality. So he's again playing with the document and the notion of documentary photography and kind of rubbing against it, saying that, you know, because I think for a long time photography has been a critique of itself, of the veracity of an image and whether it has, you know, any bearing to truth or not. So it's been a very kind of a long, and there's a lot of theory that's gone behind it, and there's been a lot of ideas and artists trying to kind of peel back the layers of what can we read as truth in photography, and when is it untruthful, or is that even a worthwhile discussion to have?
In fact, one of your early teachers said the one thing you shouldn't do is don't take a photograph of a photograph, meaning her advice to you was not to get involved in that discourse inside photographic tradition in that way. I assume that's what you meant.
Yeah, I didn't want to work to slip into a critique of itself. I mean, there was a lot of that going on. I still held on to the hope that, as a contemporary artist, that the photographs can still have some storytelling and meaning through how I choose my subjects and how I begin to describe them. That they can actually begin to impart a kind of a human story, not just a story about the internal mechanism or the mechanisms of the medium.
I'm sure there are the other questions, but it is almost 10 o'clock. I'd like to thank you a lot. The one thing I do want to say is, I suppose all of you in the audience know that Ed gave the most extraordinary gift to the Waters Art Gallery of 53 of his images, which makes the KWAG the envy as far as photographic collection goes of almost every museum in the country, including the National Gallery. I think it's a sign of his generosity and his commitment to the world in which he comes from that he gave that generous gift. So thank you all for coming tonight. Here we go. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, it's easy. It's great.
suggestions for photographs in the
Oh, sure. It's not about me here. It's about these guys. Sure. Then, yeah. Well, you know, you do the research. You watch. I mean, he's wonderful to watch. Just even what everything he does, you can just. I mean, I had 50 questions worked out in my notebook. I probably asked 10 of them. Oh, and